for years until someone suddenly realised. You know, that's the sort of cheeky larrikinism about the guy, I guess. And he hasn't lost it. I went up when I was doing that book on the Anthony family to stay up at his place at Mwullumbah, because he's got a whole heap of material in a barn up there which I needed to look at. And they'd renovated the dairy, an old dairy, into a beautiful, you know, like a self-contained flat. It's lovely. So I was staying down there. Anyway, Doug would get me up every morning at about 6, go for a walk, you know. God, I mean, I'm just not an early morning bloke at all. But on the day that I was coming back, I was flying out of Coolangatta probably at about midday. Doug was going to give me a lift up to Coolangatta. But sure enough, bell on the door, 5:30. "That you, Paul? Are you there, Paul?" "Yes, Doug, yes." "Get up. I thought you might like to come down and have a look at the cattle." Well, he and his farm manager is a guy called Barney. They'd got a mob of probably about 80-odd head of cattle yarded in the yards. And I go down with Doug. And, of course, Doug says, "Oh, yeah, yeah. Thought we might put you on the gate there, Paul, and you can help, and I'll shove them in the race. You can do the gate, and Barney can change their ear tags." And I said, "Yes, sure, Doug, okay." So I'm doing this, no problem. I've done this sort of work. The only trouble was I only had a decent pair of boots on. I had no work boots, and here I am slopping around in all this cow crap and everything. And the job gets done, and we get back up there, and I try to hose off the boots, but yeah, a fair amount of it had sort of dried on the bottom of boots, and it was halfway up my trousers and everything else. And, you know, Doug's smiling away quite benignly as though nothing has happened, and drops me off at the airport, and I get on the plane. Well, I'll tell you one thing, nobody sat next to me on the plane going back. Yeah, he would have done that on purpose. Yeah.
Anything else about Doug Anthony you'd like to say?
Oh, no, that probably sums him up. Margot, of course, is most certainly worth mentioning. It. I mean, she undoubtedly is the strength behind, I mean, you know, behind every man there's a strong woman. There's no doubt Margot Anthony. Margot Anthony was a huge help to Doug's political career, in that, apart from the fact that she's just got a delightful personality, when you first meet Margot Anthony, you know, her face lights up and you feel that she's known you for years. It's that sort of personality. She was a brilliant, and still is, a brilliant concert pianist. And she used to go and play at embassies when they went overseas. They'd invite, you know, ambassadors to the Australian embassy, or she actually went to, she went and played in the residence of one of the Russian ministers on a trip to Russia, and playing all this, concert type stuff, opera, well, not opera, but yeah, main music, very well. And that was an enormous little help in terms of international relations. You know, it's just, Doug used to quite often hear when there were visiting ministers coming out here from overseas countries, he'd invite them round to his house here in Canberra. Just for a barbecue, just to relax. Margot would play the piano. So many of them would put that down as the greatest memory they ever had of a visit to Australia. You know, so, no, they were a great team, and they still are, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, thank you for that. That was a very good response. I'm hoping now to move on to 1986, when the Nationals in Queensland won an outright majority in the state parliament, and the Joe for Canberra campaign was launched the following year, I think in 87. The aim being that Joe Bjelke-Petersen would become Prime Minister.
Mm.
You were Federal Director still, weren't you? So, how did you respond to
this? Yeah, well, that was another.
Did you see it coming?
No, I don't think we did. I don't think we did. Joe won almost a majority in 1983 in Queensland, and then he was able to govern in his own right because two Liberals defected to the Nationals, and that gave him the majority. And then, as you say, 1986, all the polls in 1986 in Queensland were predicting that Jay would lose right across the country, just the whole lot of them. Yeah, he was absolutely on the nose. Now, I wasn't closely associated with the campaign, but Joe won, and he not only won, he won in his own right. I mean, it was such a staggering turnaround from what the opinion polls were saying. It was quite amazing. And, of course, everybody was delighted in the party. Good luck to him. This was great stuff. And then, as you say, out of the blue, I think it was probably, you know, early January of 87, he came out with this bizarre sort of line in typical Joe speak that he was going to take over the policy of the national, of the federal party, and the federal party would follow his policies, and oh my goodness me, and this and that and everything else, and off she went, and it started from there, and this became another absolutely horrendous time, and Joe upped the ante on Sinclair, you know, saying that Sinclair should stand down, and Joe was going to be the leader. And we had a federal council arranged for March of that year, and the Queensland delegation to the federal council was going to move that the federal party immediately break from the coalition in opposition, this was, with John Howard. There was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing going on at organisational level there, because if the Queenslanders got the numbers on federal council, not only would they force that through, but basically they'd have the numbers to take over the finances and the assets of the federal party and virtually do what they like with them. I mean, it was, and you know, Ian Sinclair wasn't going to allow that. New South Wales certainly wasn't going to allow that. There was a lot of behind the scenes anxiety there about the assets of the party, what would happen to them. And the numbers were very closely, very finely balanced. I mean, the whole of the Queensland delegation, federal council in these days had about 45 voting delegates or thereabouts. I mean, Queensland probably had 6 or 7 delegates. New South Wales would have had about the same. Victoria, yes, similar. South Australia and Western Australia, smaller numbers. But Queensland had a block. At least half of the delegates from Western Australia supported Queensland. South Australia was a bit iffy. Victoria was a bit iffy. It wasn't 100% behind the status quo, if you like. New South Wales was. So the numbers were pretty finely balanced. In the end, Joe actually backtracked a little bit himself. He announced that because of the possibility of an imminent federal election, he wasn't going to force a break in the coalition at that time. But he expected the coalition to break, as early as appropriate and as convenient. He stood there in federal council, stuck his hands up in the air and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I have good news for you this morning. My goodness me, the coalition is dead." Now, you may say, as a federal council, you may say and do and make the decisions which you are entitled to make, but it will make no iota, not one bit of iota of difference to what I am going to do for the betterment of this country. And off he just left. Then he took off and went back to Brisbane. But he had stepped back that little margin. Not that it was very helpful, because of course the whole issue kept boiling on and on and on, and of course Bob Hawke, as he absolutely should have done, called an early election to capitalise on it. Sinclair, it was extremely hard on Ian Sinclair, because even during the election campaign, you had the likes of the Queensland president Bob Sparks, who was a very powerful character in the party, saying publicly on radio, in the middle of an election campaign, you know, that Sinclair should stand down. That if he's re-elected leader, even if he gets back into parliament, if he's re-elected leader, he won't be there for long. All of this sort of stuff. The whole plan, though, the Joe for PM campaign, it was so unprofessional. It was almost as though somebody had had a bad dream and tried to put it immediately into place without, without even thinking it through, even remotely. Because it didn't take long before it got watered down from Jofa PM to Jofa Canberra. So it was stepping back from that bit. Then he turned round and he was caught on the hop when Hawke called the election, which was, he called it in about July. Joe had gone off to America, to the States, to promote Brisbane's Expo, the 88 Expo in Brisbane, to promote it to business and industry over there. Well, he was over there. He had to hightail it back to Queensland faster than fast. And then he realised that, there wasn't a seat available for him. Could he find a seat in time? The close of nominations was rapidly coming along. Then he made the decision that no, he wouldn't run for wouldn't be running for a federal seat. So there was another back down. But he still continued to make a complete nuisance of himself by supporting and endorsing Joe Independent candidates all over the country. There were Joe Independents that ran against both Ian Sinclair and Ralph Hunt, who was then Sinclair's deputy. And other people, Joe Independents ran in every seat, or they were funded by Queensland to run in every seat in Western Australia and in South Australia, about 13 seats, didn't win any seats. The vast majority of those candidates even blew their deposits. But nonetheless, it was thoroughly destabilising, and it caused enormous damage and splits and divisions within the national parties at all levels. Of course, the result of the election was that Howard and Sinclair lost. They argue to this day very strongly that they lost because of Joe. And there could be some justification in that, because Hawke was not travelling too well at that stage. He might have been, I think Hawke was beatable. And when you look at the destabilisation caused by the Joe campaign, the result for the coalition, and particularly for the National Party, was actually quite strong. So had that Joe campaign not been in play, I think the National Party vote would have been a lot stronger, it would have been a lot more unified, they might have won more seats, and it might have got rid of Bob Hawke at that point. It might easily have done. But the upshot of it all was, you had a hugely divided party. You had the Queenslanders, not recognising the Federal Party. During the campaign, in fact, I had a couple of occasions where I was told by the Queensland campaign director that I couldn't put out, or I was told not to circulate the federal policy, which at the time was to abolish Labor's assets test. Don't circulate that in Queensland, because the Queensland Party was supporting a tax policy that had been drafted by John Stone, who was a former Treasury head and subsequently became a senator, and who Joe employed to draft his tax policy. And the Stone tax policy was not going to abolish assets tests, so we weren't allowed to put out to our candidates in Queensland what a federal policy was. And when I told Sinclair about this, he said, right, well, go and get printed up a flyer, a brochure on our policy that we'll abolish the assets test. Let's get some radio interviews cut, radio ads cut, 30-second radio ads, which we recorded with Ian Sinclair. And he said, right, now send them all up to Queensland, book the radio ads direct from Canberra onto Queensland radio stations, ignore the Queensland organisation, get the stuff out to the candidates. And so, it was horrendously acrimonious. It was just a shocking time. But the upshot of it all was that we, how the hell could we try and heal the party? That was the challenge. And, as you do, I was talking to Ian Sinclair about it. The federal president, then newly elected, was Stuart MacDonald, who'd taken over from Shirley McCarrow. They were both Victorians, and we came up with the idea that we'd better have a serious and it had to be a serious, had to be seen to be a serious review into the party. And who would we get to undertake it, and how could we make sure that all the parties would be happy to go along with it? Well, the answers came up as, will you get Nixon to chair it? Because Peter Nixon, who of course had retired from Parliament, was still well known and well regarded by the parties right around the Commonwealth, and in particular got on reasonably well with Joe. Joe quite liked him. So Nixon was to chair it. Righto, obviously you had to have somebody on that committee, the review committee, who would represent Queensland. We chose a guy called David Russell, who was on the Queensland Executive, who was a QC, so it would be handy in terms of constitutional issues and things like that. He was a, you know, he was a pro-Joe guy, or had been a pro-Joe guy, but he wasn't a complete lunatic in that context, you know, so he would be useful. The one concern about him was that he was an amalgamationist, but nonetheless, you know, he could represent Queensland. We got the West Australian president, a guy called John Paterson, who was, as it were, representative of the smaller states. And then Ralph Hunt, who just retired from Parliament at that stage, came on to represent New South Wales and also the interests of the Federal Parliamentary Party. Now, that committee went off and did its work, and I was the secretary to it, so, you know, I did most of the drafting of the report and everything else. The report came out. It completely revised the federal constitution of the party so that you could never have, for instance, J.B. Peterson or a state organisation endorsing candidates to run in federal electorates where in a state where there was a registered or an affiliated federal party. It basically made the amendments that were necessary to constitutionally protect the party federally from that sort of assault, either electorally or in terms of party assets. And party assets were important. The party organisation federally, you've got the Federal Secretariat, which is owned by a company called John McEwen House Proprietary Limited. And that building, it's prime real estate, virtually within the Parliamentary Triangle sort of area, you know, opposite the Currajong Hotel. It's a beautiful bit of real estate. That is owned outright by the party. That'd be worth a lot of money. So you've got that, plus there are the invested assets of John McEwen House in other areas. I don't know what those are anymore, but nonetheless, I mean, you're not talking about simply a shell company, you know, you're talking about something where if it was taken over by a state party, it could have serious implications, obviously, for the, you know, for the federal party in terms of its well, financial security anyway. But we did this report. It was accepted by a federal council meeting in 1988, and of course there were necessary subsequent amendments that needed to be made to state party constitutions, and they by and large were taken on board and progressively implemented, and everything sort of settled down, and you know, so yeah, settled down to back to the status quo, if you like. But it, Sinclair, you know, thwarted the thing. You could say Sinclair won. He did. He beat Joe Bjelke-Petersen. But it was the beginning of the end of Sinclair too. It damaged him in an almost irreparable way. He was challenged for the leadership after the 87 election by, certainly by Ray Braithwaite, who was the Queensland member for Dawson. Not because Ray was a Queenslander, Ray was actually a pro Federal Party guy, but because he felt that Sinclair had not adequately addressed how he was going to handle the Joe factor, if you like, in the future. At that stage, of course, he didn't know that this committee was going to be made up, neither did any of us probably, but Ian Sinclair's leadership was weakened, and of course only 2 years later they dumped him in favour of Charles Blunt, which was an absolute disaster. In a way, Ian brought it on himself. He sort of became a bit too distant from the parliamentary members. He was more inclined to go out and have, you know, dinner in the dinner break with his staff than with his parliamentary colleagues. Some unfairly believed that he was favouring some members over others and not giving them promotion when they deserved it. I dispute that myself. I think the evidence clearly shows that Ian gave some of the younger members responsibilities, which, you know, promotions responsibilities. So they might not have paid money because we were in opposition, but he gave them parliamentary secretary positions within the party and things like that. He did try to do a bit of grooming, but he alienated himself. And I remember we used to have these leaders' dinners once a month in opposition in John Howard's office in Parliament House. By this stage, we've moved into the new Parliament House. But so there was Sinclair and John Howard, and then the deputy leaders, was Bruce Lloyd from Victoria for the National Party, and who was the deputy Liberal leader? I'm not sure. But then you had Fred Cheney from the Senate. Anyway, it was about six of us, and then two directors, Tony Eggleton and myself. After one of these dinners, I remember saying to Ian, there was a half bottle of red wine left, and we both agreed we had time to sit there and finish that off, so we did. And I said to him, I remember saying to him, "Look, Ian, you've really got to be careful with the troops. You know, I'm hearing rumblings, the troops aren't too happy, you know." "Oh yes, Paul, I know. Look, I know." I mean, Ian was always a bit like that. "You know, I know, Paul. Yes, I know. I know. Yes, look, I'll fix it. Don't worry about it." But, well, Ian never did, not adequately, and the party, the parliamentary party, rebelled, and on the same night that they rebelled against John Howard, because there was a rebellion against Howard going on in the Liberal Party, the Nats felt they'd better do the same. And then we got Charles Blunt, and Charles Blunt was ex-state director in New South Wales. As an administrator and administrative director, he was extremely good. He had a good political mind on him too. I mean, Doug Anthony was sufficiently confident in him to, in a way, facilitate. He didn't facilitate per se, but to encourage Charles Blunt to stand in the seat of Richmond and succeed him, Doug Anthony, when Anthony retired. And Charles Blunt did that, and he won the seat handsomely, so that was 84. And he retained the seat. He wasn't a bit, you know, he had a good political mind, but he was thrust into that leadership. He might have been ambitious for it, but he wasn't ready for it. Mm-hmm. And it was a complete disaster. It didn't work. And of course, we went into the election in 1990, and that was an absolute disaster because Blunt lost his seat. As a federal leader, he lost his seat. And I think the party was reduced to about 14 members, which was getting down, you know, down to the skid levels. They were difficult times, those. Very difficult times. Ian Sinclair, I mean, I've always enjoyed Ian. He's great fun, very sociable guy, very generous guy in many respects. But also in other respects, infuriating. You could go into Ian's office in the morning and there'd be a stack of papers this high on the left-hand side of his desk, and he's always complaining about how busy he is and this and that. And you go there in the evening, exactly the same stack of papers has moved over to this side of his desk, and basically he's looked at them, procrastinated, decided to do nothing and shoved it over there. And that was, particularly in opposition, I never worked with him when he was a minister because he had staff, a lot more staff then, and departmental staff. But as opposition leader, I had a lot to do with him because I was the federal director. He procrastinated too much. He wouldn't bite the bullet on something enough. Although, having said that, I mean, he may, don't misunderstand me, maybe he, when the Joe campaign was getting underway, one of the key arguments of the Queenslanders were that we had to split from coalition because we weren't allowed to put forward our own policies. And Ian said to me, right, well, we'll put the nail into this. We will write our own set of policies and I will present them at the Federal Council meeting in March. This was 87. In fact, in 84, after he took over the leadership, Ian asked me to pull together a draft for his approval and everything else, a booklet of Federal Party policies, which we did, and it was, you know, quarter of an inch thick. There were policies across the board, only bullet point stuff, but that's really all you need, which, you know, covered everything from the environment to Aboriginal affairs to primary production to exports to the economy, women's affairs, you name it, youth, all sorts of things. And we did the same thing for 1987, just to prove that the party could indeed put forward its own policy positions separately from the Liberal Party while still being in coalition. So, I mean, you know, he knew, he had a, again, like all of them, they, he had a good political mind in terms of knowing what needed to be done to fix a problem. But there were times, I think, when he, as I say, he shoveled the paper from one side to the other without paying too much attention to it.
What was the real basis of the attack on Ian Sinclair by Joe Bjelke-Petersen? Well, I mean, when I say real, do you think there was a more kind of fundamental, even political, philosophical type basis?
No, I don't think there was anything too politically or deeply philosophical about it. I think a lot of people, after that election win in 1986, a lot of people in Queensland, on the Gold Coast, business people, the so-called White Shoe Brigade type people, people seem to have a lot of money, they got into Joe's ears and said, mate, we need you to, you should be the Prime Minister of this country. We'll put money behind a campaign. And I think it really took off from that. I don't think there was any deep philosophical thought about it. I think they got into Joe's ear and Joe was at the stage where he thought, that sounds quite a good idea. He went off and started running the race on it without talking to Bob Sparks or the Queensland organisation. And I know that Bob was basically quite horrified at the direction that it was going. He realised that he had to try and do something to help Joe because Joe was just flying off like a Catherine wheel out of control. So Sparks would think a lot more about it, and Sparks would have discerned that, well, wait a minute, that is this salvageable, or is Joe just going to end up looking an absolute idiot, which clearly Sparks would not want to happen. So Sparks hauled the thing back and tried to put it onto a course that may be or that might conceivably have been workable. That's to say, get the man into Parliament. Let's see how we, you know, if we get him elected into Parliament, then let's see how he goes in terms of party elections and things like that. But right at the word go, I think it was as simple as people get into Joe's ear saying, we need you as the Prime Minister. You should be the Prime Minister. I think it was as simple as that. Yeah.
He struck me as being a very different person to Ian Sinclair, as somebody who was merely an outsider following politics at the time.
Oh, Joe?
Yes.
Oh, you're a totally different person to Sinclair. The two never got on very well. I think Joe would have regarded Sinclair as, well, you know, you're a lawyer. Whereas, you know, Joe was, a self-taught peanut farmer, basically. And I don't think he had much time for Sinclair. He did have a fair bit of time for Nixon. He had fights with the likes of Doug Anthony over various things. But they all sort of got on, but no, he didn't like Sinclair.
Sinclair like liberal in some of his attitudes? I mean, the small L liberal.
Well, he was a he was accused, and this was one of the things that led to his leader, his the downfall of his leadership. Yeah, and indeed, in that, well, throughout the period of his leadership, if you like, the era of his leadership, that's what, 84 to 89, he was seen on some issues to be too accommodating to the Liberals, or too willing to go along with a Liberal policy direction on, you know, issues which were of core value to the National Party. Wheat marketing was one, and wheat marketing, in fact, was the well, the excuse which caused the revolt ultimately against his leadership, because the Liberal Party, this was to deregulate the domestic wheat market. The government was going to deregulate the domestic wheat market. The Liberal Party was reasonably happy to go along with that. The National Party was basically very strongly opposed to it. And Sinclair was seen to have reached a sort of a compromise with the Libs without adequately referring to the parliamentary party. And that was the excuse or the reason they used to nail him. But the interesting point is that having nailed him, they never made any attempt to change the policy on export wheat marketing. So, you know, but there were other issues. There were other occasions where people thought that Ian was too willing to accept what the Liberal Party said.
I was thinking not just in terms of Liberal Party, but I'm actually thinking of the Playboy interview that he did. You know that that sort of. I could never see Joe doing such a...
Oh, no. Joe would have been horrified at that. That would have been sacrilege to Joe. Yes, look, that's right. And I mean, Sinclair was, you know... Joe would have regarded Sinclair as being small L liberal, far too debonair, you know, just not the right sort of person to be leading the Country Party. I mean, he just would have written it off like that.
You mentioned that you had dealings with Joe directly when you were a journalist and liked him and got on well with him. Did you have actual personal dealings with him during this period when you were federal director? And he...
No, I didn't. I remember saying good day to him when he came to that federal council in 1987, early 87, and it was just a polite, you know, how do you do, Mr. Premier? And you know, oh yes, Paul, my goodness me, how are you? This and that. But no, I didn't. I was in probably a bit of a difficult situation, in that there was quite evidently a battle royal going on between Sinclair and Bjarke Petersen, and I was quite obviously in a role where my responsibility was to support the federal leader of the party. So I had no reason myself to directly try and get involved or to talk to Joe about things like this. Others did. Peter Nixon was sent up to Queensland and also came up to Canberra to talk to him, try and persuade him to change his mind. The federal president did. Sinclair tried to. And my liaison was certainly with his office, with his press sec. But that didn't get anywhere either. You know? I mean, we were just, it was just enemy stuff. You know, they were in one camp, I was in another, and that's all there was to it. Ken Crook was with Joe at the time, I knew Ken very well beforehand, and I know him very well now. Even at that stage, I mean, we were good mates and we were great mates, but we didn't contact each other much when that was going on. There was no point.
Would you say that was the biggest challenge of your period as federal director?
Oh, I think so, yeah. I mean, it was, definitely. I mean, when you're faced with a situation where you're trying to organise and help run a federal election campaign in which your own party is split, spitting chips at each other and running separate campaigns, and then you're faced with a situation where in the post-election sense you have the state and federal parties that are grossly divided in a way that probably hadn't been divided to such an extent at any time in the history of the parties, and you've got to try and fix that up. It took a long time, and it took a lot of work.
Now, you left that position in 1992. Had it been healed by then, would you say, the division?
It came back on track. It came back on track quite quickly, actually. The Nixon, as it was then called, became known, the Nixon Report, that laid down the framework for constitutional and other operational changes. In terms of relationships between state and federal parties and secretariats and all the rest of it. That helped a lot. Joe, of course, didn't last that much longer as Premier in Queensland. He retired. So that took out of play that sort of contentious element, if you like, and Micah Hearn came in. I think it was Micah Hearn. He got on very well with Sinclair. So the relationship between the parliamentary parties settled down, and by the time 92 came round, everything was running quite sweetly and back.